Oddballs and the Paranormal News, we had the cat who came back after 10 years away from its owner, and the ghost of Mary Queen of Scots. The cryptic corner of the show has the Lizard Man of Skateboard Swamp. And our special guest has a new book out that's been compared to an actual episode of The Twilight Zone. If it's odd to you, friend, it's on the Odd to Newfoundland.
It's the odd to Newfoundland. Ghostly greetings from your host, Jonathan. Mysteries, ghosts, monsters, and lore. East Coast esoterica and so much more. If it's up to you, friend, it's on the up to Newfoundland.
Ghostly greetings from the oldest city in North America. I'm your host, John Mallard, bringing you the best in East Coast esoterica. You, my friends, have stumbled upon the Odd the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. Welcome to episode 94 of your monthly paranormal variety show. 6 years of being in your ears. Having your hair is better than, you know, brain on a camper roof, or seeing your sworn enemy is after putting on weight during COVID-19. Ha ha ha. Why? Because you're wonderful. A masterpiece. Beautifully made. Important to people because you're important to me. Highly favored by your creator, or the law of averages and physics working in tandem, you, my friend, are an oddball. And on this show, your family, and we are one. 94 episodes in, 6 years in, and I'd just like to thank you all for being here today. August is here. The summer's winding down. I guess school is starting up. I'm pretty sure it's starting up in my part, my neck of the woods. I don't know about you guys. But anyway, the kids are going back, and you're probably going to have a little bit of extra time, right? A little bit of extra time. So do me a favor, will you? Subscribe to the show. Leave yourself a little comment somewhere along the line. Maybe there's something you hear on this show that you really liked. Maybe you want to say something to our guest who's going to be on later on the show, Terrence Hawkins. Maybe you want to ask him a couple of questions or something about his books. He's got a really good one out. It's just like The Twilight Zone, apparently. You're going to really enjoy our interview. I really do think. Just to check in a little tiny bit with me now, of course, it's been a pretty rough, couple of months, I think, in everyone's life through this whole COVID thing. And, I just hope everyone's doing well. Everyone in my family is healthy and safe, and that's all that matters. I hope the same thing is going on with yours. I see my numbers have started to increase in the United States, which means only one thing. Most of you are over the COVID virus now. You're over it. You're over it. Or, you know, I actually think it's because people are commuting back to work. You know, some work is starting to open up now, and people usually listen to this podcast on the way to work. You know, they have an hour long commute. Perfect. Throw on John and all of his crazy friends. Betty and Laura back this month to celebrate 6 years as well. They were so good to me this month. They actually got their stuff in super early. And Betty just totally goes on a total, like, spiritual rampage for almost 25 minutes. I think you're going to love this one for Betty. You know, she said it was spiritual diarrhea, she said she had. She just had to let it all out. And which didn't surprise me at all, because I hadn't seen or heard from Betty in a couple of months. So it was really nice to have her back for the show. And Laura's actually got a pretty cool piece this show, too, although it's not as long as Betty's. It's only a few minutes long, but it's actually kind of cool, man. She's talking about social distancing that's been going on in the animal kingdom for very many, many years, with a focus this time on the plant kingdom, where she's actually talking about how plants have distanced themselves and stuff. It's really, really neat. So stick around. I think you'll love that. Betty's rampage, Laura's crazy plants that, you know, just need their own personal space, and, of course, Terrence Hawkins, who apparently wrote a book. It's just like watching an episode of The Twilight Zone. Stick around for all that. Now, before we go any further, of course, it's important we shout out all of our new subscribers on Podbean. I'd like to say thank you to Chantel, Toke Doubting, Golden, R11669T. I don't know who you are, but thanks so much, whoever you are. Victoria and Emma, thanks to you guys, you have unlocked the horrible para joke of the show. So are you ready for it? Oh God, it's a real, this one's probably one of the worst ones I've ever told, actually. This is so bad. I thought twice about it, but anyway, here we go. Okay. Why did the ghost go into the bar? for all the booze. God, I can't even slap my knee. That was so terrible. It was just God awful. So 6 years, 6 years of this show. Lots have changed in my world in 6 years, my God. But I can say this much. One of the most consistent parts of my life has been my wife and my show. And my wife is actually in the room with me right now. She's back there doing her doll thing. Say hi to Steph.
Hi.
That's my wife back there. She's trying her best to be quiet. We actually have our own room now. We're sharing a studio kind of thing. I built my little podcasting hovel corner, and she's got this doll studio, and she's making these lifelike dolls. They're called Reborns on the Rock, and just a pretty cool thing that she's picked up this amazing hobby apparently that's been inside her for many, many, many decades that we had no idea about, and here we are. She's actually selling these things online. So you'll see that link actually go up now very soon on the Odd the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast page. The reason why I haven't promoted my dear darling wife recently is because I took a Facebook break. I actually, it was like the 20th of July, and I was just like, you know what? I have got to check out because there was just so much going on that was just, I couldn't handle it. I needed to take a break from just the negativity that's on there between people constantly attacking each other. Just a very, very sad story about a family here in Newfoundland that actually lost their son, who's only four, in a horrible accident. I think about that. I think about some other things that were going on. It was just, you know what? Time to pull the plug and just chill. And I'm glad I did it, but here I am. I'm back today. It's the 1st of August, and the first thing I do is promote my wife. So there you go. All right, moving right along now. Let's jump into the paranormal news. We've been doing this for 6 years. We should be getting pretty good at this by now. I'll see you on the other side of the ad. Before we dig in and get going with the paranormal news, just want to do a big shout out to our current sponsor, Accusonus. Can't say enough good stuff about these guys and gals who make me sound so much better at this than I actually am. They go in there, they take my high quality audio, and they make it, well, higher quality audio. They edit out every breath. They make it sound amazing. Oh, who am I kidding? I'm the one doing all the work. But you see, they've made it so I can do these things with the turn of a dial. For instance, this show, let's talk about the Accusonus Voice Leveler. What an amazing piece of equipment. This simple little thing can turn a podcasting interview just into something you don't have to edit as much. And that's so important if you're into podcasting as much as I am, and a lot of my paranormal friends out there are. Let's say you got a guest and they're talking too loud through Skype and you don't really have time to adjust their levels. Next thing you know, you got to record. Boom. You got a very loud speaker and you're more of a quieter one. So what do you got to do? You got to go back and change their voice and Audacity or whatever, you know, editor you guys use. And you got to make them quiet. And that's time consuming, especially if you're getting into hour long interviews like some of these shows do. So Accusonus is amazing. Imagine just highlighting your work and just going right into that noise leveler, that voice leveler. And with a turn of a knob, it edits it for you. That's right. It does the work for you. I mean, come on. I love these guys. And you think the leveler is cool? Man, just wait till you see the noise removal system. And my personal favorite, the Deverberator, which actually takes the echo out of a room. This is like a must-have for everybody out there who is into this kind of stuff. You gotta do it. Anyhow, check out Accusonus. The link will be down in the show notes. Let's go ahead and let's jump into the paranormal news.
Somewhere between the funnies and the obituaries is... Oh, yes, the paranormal news.
There's a voice that keeps on calling me. Down the road is where I'll always be. Every step I make a new friend. Can't stay for long, just turn around and I'm gone again. Maybe tomorrow I wanna settle down. Until tomorrow I'll just keep moving on.
You know, every time I hear that song, all I can think about is that just amazing dog in that show. And unfortunately, though, this is actually a segue to a cat. And we all know that I'm a cat lover. In fact, just this last 2 days, I've started to have to retrain my cat to go to the potty because, you know, she just loves peeing on my floor. So I have to take my cat down the basement now and put her in her litter. Like, I literally have to train my cat. And you wonder who really rules the world, right? You do. It's definitely the animals. Cats are no exception. But anyhow, why in the heck would I play that song leading into a story about a cat? Well, this cat really was the littlest hobo. After 10 years, a microchip brings a Utah cat home to her owner. It's a heartwarming story about what is unquestionably one tough little kitty. Everybody loves a good touching animal story, and this one is no exception. But it's not often that you come across a story that makes you feel this good. A Utah woman has just been reunited with her cat that left to roam the world on its own more than a decade ago. This story begins in the late 2000s. Back then, the woman in question, who was chosen to remain anonymous, was just a high school girl with a black and brown cat she named, well, Mocha, of course. While we don't know the details, we can assume that their life was nothing out of the ordinary for a high schooler and her cat. That was, of course, until the day that Mocha went missing. To this day, her owner doesn't know how Mocha got away. Maybe she slipped through the door that was left ajar, or maybe even a crack window, but that is beside the point. Her disappearance left the poor girl devastated. She and her family looked for ages, but the cat was nowhere to be found. She didn't want to eat, nor did she want to go to school. The only thing that mattered to her was to find Mocha. Time pressed on, and the hopes of Mocha ever coming back grew dimmer with the passing of each day. Finally, the girl and her family were forced to concede that the cat was gone for good. This had a big impact on Mocha's owner, but eventually she was forced to move on from the loss, City Animal Shelter in Utah recently posted. Why are we suddenly mentioning an animal shelter here? Well, the answer to that should be pretty self-evident. Very soon, in early July, a person came to the animal shelter and brought with them a cat. It was a black and brown stray that had been feeding for the past 10 years as a kind of an outdoor pet. Unfortunately, due to the personal reason they had to move from Tolee, concerned that there would be no one there to feed the cat, they decided to bring it to the shelter. The shelter manager had a feeling to scan the cat upon hearing the story, so a technician scanned it. The animal shelter announcement said, they were surprised to find that the cat had a registered microchip. They called the chip company and were given the contact information for the cat's owners. When the shelter contacted the owners, a very confused couple answered the phone. They explained that they had once had a cat, but that cat had run away more than 10 years ago, and by now, it must certainly be dead. We bet you already know where this is going. A tearful meeting, despite the overwhelming odds. The shelter asked the owners to come and see the cat anyway. Maybe she'd look familiar, and if not, at least they'd be closure there. The owners arrived at the shelter on July 16th. They took a look at the cat, and it was most definitely Mocha. Immediately upon seeing her, the father said he remembered this cat. He said he was going to go home and contact his daughter, who lived in her own place with her family in another city, the shelter said. In the years that had passed, Mocha's owner had grown up. She'd moved away, gotten married, and had children. Their family also had a dog and another cat. An hour later, a very excited and shocked woman turned up at the shelter. She said her parents called her about the cat, the shelter announcement read. The shelter workers led her to the cat, and she burst into tears of joy pretty much immediately as she recognized her. That's right, after 10 years, she was finally reunited with little Mocha. Can't stay for long, just turn around and I'm gone again. Maybe tomorrow, I wanna settle down. Until tomorrow. I'm kind of jealous, not gonna lie to you. Like, my cat is not that self-reliant. That is explaining to you that I literally have to pee my cat. I have to take my cat to the bathroom. Man, oh man, it's time to cast my cat overboard. I'm only kidding, I love my cat, my kitty. But, speaking of getting tossed overboard, listen, you better be in shape before you go to Venice when all this COVID-19 is over, because guess what? People are getting the boot for being overweight, okay? Venice is now limiting passenger numbers on gondolas because of, quote-unquote, fatter tourists. This got people in an all-total outrage in Venice, and people are not handling this very well. The maximum weight limit are there for a reason, but this is just ridiculous. Venice and its gondolas, we all know the scene, you know? Gondolier singing in Italian as he rows a couple of lovebirds at night through the city's canals. It's one of the most recognizable local attractions in the world, and although one could question how smart it is with the coronavirus, tourists have begun to return to Venice to take rides on the gondolas. While the Venetians will undoubtedly welcome the tourists after COVID-19 ravaged their tourism industry, they've had some changes. Yeah, some very offensive ones, apparently. Namely, the city is lowering the number of people allowed on gondolas at one time. The change is not due to the virus and social distancing, though. It's because the gondolas are at the risk of sinking under the ever-increasing weight of tourists. Yeah, that's right. We are actually the problem. The tourists flocking to Venice are simply getting too overweight for the gondolas to safely keep them afloat. Now, president of Venice's Gondolier Association laments to The Guardian that tourists have gotten noticeably heavier over the past 10 to 15 years. And unlike in a lift where there's a message that says only 6 people are maximum weight, we don't have scales to weigh people. So we have to reduce the number of passengers. The larger De Prada gondolas, used mostly on the Grand Canal, will now take 12 passengers on board instead of the previous 14. The smaller Donanola gondolas dropped the count from 6 to 5. But the good news is, guess what? If you're a couple, you should be in the clear. I don't know, though. After this whole COVID thing, I'm starting to think that I'm looking down at the old pooch here, and I don't know. I might have to be just the 2 people myself. I'm Idaho, an Idaho Statesman article. I love this stuff. First UFOs, now Bigfoot. Idaho is among the top states for more paranormal sightings than anywhere else. But why? What is so big about Idaho? Last month, Idaho was named the top spot in the United States for sightings of unidentified flying objects. But it turns out UFOs aren't the only paranormal entity being spotted in the Gem State. According to analysis by SatelliteInternet.com, Idaho is one of the top places for Bigfoot sightings in the country. The company last month researched UFO sightings to try to determine if satellite internet equipment was being mistaken for UFOs, which it frequently is. Last week, the website released a similar rating, this time for Squatch sightings. We dug into reports from the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization and compared it against state population data to see where people have the best chance of befriending a Bigfoot. Yeah, like you want a friend that big. The company's analysis actually wrote this out in a research paper. The Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization, or BFRO, has 93 reports of Bigfoot encounters in Idaho. Yeah, that's a lot. Meaning every 100,000 people in Idaho, about 5 of them have seen or heard a Sasquatch. That per capita rate earned Idaho, or as I like to refer to it as, I'm Idaho, 4th place in the ranking of most Bigfoot sightings. Of course, it's not a perfect metric. When SatelliteInternet.com was measuring UFO sightings, it pared the results down to the last 18 months. However, reports on the BFOR organization website date back as far as the 1960s, which makes the results a little less precise. Using the data, though, this named Washington the top state in the country for Bigfoot sightings, with nearly 9 sightings per 100,000 people. That makes sense given the state's long history with the hairy cryptid, though. Oregon came in 2nd place with 6 sightings per capita, and West Virginia took 3rd place with 5.8 sightings per capita. So do you think there's a correlation between the UFOs and the Bigfoot? Come on! Do you think Bigfoots are there to see UFOs? Do you think UFOs are actually dropping off Bigfoots there? I know one thing, I'm Idaho, and I'm moving on. How about this one? This one is really interesting. An intriguing hotel where guests claim they see the ghost of Mary Queen of Scots. The Haycock Manor Hotel in Wansford has attracted many guests over the years, with some claiming Mary Queen of Scots visited the spot on her way to her imprisonment in Fotherington Castle. The East England is steeped in history with castles, cathedrals, and even hotels with curious tales to tell. Many hauntings are afoot. One particular spot in Waynesford, near Peterborough, has become a place of interest to those learning about the past and those fascinated by the paranormal, reports the Cambridgeshire Live. The stunning Haycock Manor Hotel dates back to the 16th century and is a former coaching inn by the banks of the River Nene that is thought to have been visited by some famous faces over the years. Amongst the notable guests is said to be Mary, Queen of Scots, once spent the night at the hotel herself. It's claimed that Mary, Queen of Scots, was lodged at the Haycock on her way to her imprisonment and later her execution, which could explain why she might be sticking around. Mary was buried in Peterborough Cathedral, but 25 years later, her son James I had her moved into an ornate marble tomb in Westminster Abbey to rest alongside her cousins Elizabeth I and Mary Tudor. But the thing is, you disturb a grave, well, crazy stuff starts happening. While the royal didn't spend long at the hotel, guests have claimed to see the ghost of Mary Queen of Scots during their stay at Haycock. According to the website Haunted Rooms, hauntedrooms.co.uk, those who have stayed in older parts of the hotel have experienced some unusual goings-on. The website reads, guests at the hotel have reported various ghostly goings-on, including sightings of figures in public areas, especially in the oldest part of the hotel. Guests at the hotel have also reported someone in the room with them. According to the Haycock Motel, Mary Queen of Scots wasn't the only royal to have taken lodgings. Princess Alexandra Victoria, later to be crowned Queen Victoria, stayed at the Haycock on the 2nd of September, 1832, on her way to visit Archbishop of York. Similarly, during the 19th century, the Haycock hosted many European royals, including Empress Elizabeth of Austria and the Prince of Liechtenstein. So, there's been many a royal in there, but do you think they're still kicking around? I don't want to be royals. Stuck in some weird hotel. This place is kind of creepy as hell. You know what? Let's move on one more time. We all know Donald Trump's a dumbass, but the U.S. Space Force, you know, it's kind of fun. Come on. We all love this thing. I mean, first off, their emblem looks just like the Star Trek communicator. And someone's got to say that. But you know what? Fear not. For the U.S. Space Force has hired a new employee, one who will have you chomping at the bit to find out who he is. The founding of the U.S. Space Horse, excuse us, the U.S. Space Force last year took the world by surprise and slight amusement. Granted, it was a logical step in the global's arms race to see who will end up dominating the last frontier. After all, it's not like the U.S. is alone in shooting for the stars. The space wing of the U.S. military is therefore simply a tool to keep up with foreign military powers. To this end, the U.S. has stopped at no expense, and there's been a lot of expense, to outfit its valiant astro warriors with only the latest, most high-tech equipment. Like this beautiful Mustang variant that they just got. And no, it's not even a car. The freshest recruit of the U.S. Space Force is indeed a horse. In a July 23rd Twitter post, the Space Force showcased Ghost, a 5-year-old Bureau of Land Management Mustang. You can ask what business does a horse have participating in space warfare? Sure, his name is a bit ominous, but will that be enough to deter hostile forces from deploying military ordnance in the lower of Earth orbit? Then again, if traveling on horseback was good enough for Captains Kirk and Picard, it's good enough for the U.S. Space Force, if you ask me. Of course, in a slightly disappointing dose of reality here on the podcast, Ghost will not actually be going into space. It's a pity, since a horse outfitted in a spacesuit with laser guns would have been totally awesome. But alas, you know, Ghost will not receive futuristic weaponry or training. He will probably never even see a space rocket for that matter. What Ghost will be doing is joining 4 other military working horses at the Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. His latest addition to the conservation MWH program that was transferred from the Air Force to the Space Force in March 2019, according to Live Science. U.S. Air Force Senior Airman Michael Tenzas, the 30th Security Forces Squadron Conservation Patrolman, that's a mouthful, explained the role of the conservation team in a statement, which, you know, I'm sure you're dying to hear. Like, why is there a horse on this thing at all? We enforce fish and game laws, and the horses help us walk off the beaten path to complete our mission. We have been responded to lost hunters and hurt animals as well. So there you go. It's all about protecting the weak. We don't actually have a horse in space, although it would have been a pretty cool thing to have. Have you got good friends? Have you got like really close good friends? I hope you do. Well, there's one person out there who I think is probably the best friend you will ever have. This best friend kept a promise he made back in 1992 and actually split his lotto winnings with his buddy. Tom Cook and Joseph Feeney promised each other they'd split their winnings if either one of them ever won Powerball. 28 years later, Cook followed through on just that promise. I don't make a lot of promises, not because I'm a shady person, but because I have a terrible memory. I can really relate to that. Forgetting is the same as breaking with promises. Not the case for Wisconsin resident Tom Cook, though. He shook his best friend's hand back in 1992 and vowed if either of them won the Powerball, they split the winnings. I like to think if I ever won big money, I'd spread it around amongst my nearest and dearest anyhow. Like, you know, the whole Daddy Warbucks thing who pays off everyone's student loans. But, you know, this is just a whole step forward. A nice little nest egg is definitely what was made here. Tom Cook enriched Joseph Feeney's retirement a little and retired himself. They both took the cash payout of Cook's $22 million prize, leaving them each with $5.7 million after taxes. $5 million doesn't sound as much as it used to. There are over 2,000 billionaires in the world now. Jeff Bezos is on track to become a trillionaire before the end of the decade, and millionaires are in the new middle class. Still, for two retired best friends, an extra $5 million in the bank certainly upgrades their sunset years, so to speak. And they had this to say, we can pursue what we feel comfortable with. I can't think of a better way to retire, said Cook, who is looking forward to traveling once the worldwide pandemic subsides. Of course, they said they might as well have fun as well, as they both are avid fishermen and want to go all around the world fishing. Yeah, I think I'd do that too. And you know what? I hope you guys really enjoyed reeling in this episode, and especially this part of the Odd the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast, Paranormal News. We had a microchip cat that came back after 10 years. We had, you know, tourists who get bigger and bigger and apparently can't be on the gondolas as much now in Venice. Come on, guys. Come on. We can do better than this. I know we can. We have Idaho as the new forefront of UFOs and Bigfoot now for investigations. A very interesting story of the ghost of Mary Queen of Scots. And of course, the U.S. Space Force has a new, well, space horse and a best friend that, you know, kind of probably put all of our best friends to shame. Let's just be honest here. Split $22 million payout? Come on. All these stories have been odd to Newfoundland.
Hi, everybody. It's Betty, your oracle here. It's been a long time since I've spoken, actually. Since I've spoken on John's show. And congratulations, John, on your anniversary. Amazing. It's amazing. This podcast is an amazing podcast, and it goes worldwide because it's on Podbean. But since everything happened in our world, since our world turned upside down and became pandemic, I felt as if I was silenced. I had a friend who said to me after I posted a picture. For those of you who don't know, I am a hairstylist as well, as some people call me an oracle. But I've done public speaking. I've done lots of things in my life. I've got an arm's length of modalities that I use to help people with. But hairstyling has always been my go-to. And when I posted a picture of myself on Facebook wearing my mask, as I do if I'm requested to, a client happens to come in who I'm not sure about, everything is sanitized, masked. We follow all protocols here in Newfoundland. But it was interesting after I posted that picture to hear my friend say, it looks like you're being silenced. So right away, I took another picture and reposted it without the mask on. But I listened to her words and I took her words to heart, because I really had felt as if I had been silenced, not by anyone, not by any company, or not by friends, definitely not by friends or family or anything else. It just felt as if right now it's time for me to be quiet about all of this and see how things transpire. So I've been, like the rest of the world, watching, waiting, wondering what's happening with our world. And the most amazing thing that I heard through all of this, listening to all of the different countries and what all of the different countries are going through, our queen, well, we are in Canada, and of course Canada is a Commonwealth country. Basic rule by the Queen of England. When the Queen of England actually came on television early on in this pandemic and told us, if we need to, it's important to meditate, I sat back for a second and kind of went, wow, wow. Even the Queen of England is waking up. So I'm seeing this time of being closed down, locked down, quarantined, whatever word describes whatever it is we're going through right now. It feels like everything around us is changing. Not just the way we live our lives, because now there is social distance. I've always said that humans were put on Earth to be together, to share each other's germs, to whatever, you know, to interact. We can still interact, but we can interact safely. We don't need to throw our germs all over everybody. I know people who in the past, and particularly people in authority, in positions of power with different businesses, become very upset when their staff is sick. You can't be sick. You have to come to work. It makes no difference if you're sick or not. And in those days being any time before 2020, we weren't asked to wear a mask and come into work sick. We weren't asked to quarantine ourselves until we're better, to give ourselves the 14 days to get rid of whatever it is that we have. We weren't asked any of that. We were told we had to keep the wheels of finance turning. Okay? The wheels of finance stopped in March or April or whatever. We weren't out buying all of this excessive stuff that we don't need. You know, the biggest was, and the funniest in my estimation, was the toilet paper issue, which is still, it's insane in my mind. However, a few people have said to me, what is it? Why did people do that? Why did people run out and buy all of this toilet paper? And I just reminded the few people who said that to me of the word hygiene. So when we say the word hygiene, just think, where does your mind go to right away? The bathroom. It's hygiene. You clean everything up in the bathroom, in private, because that's hygiene. It didn't have anything to do with hand washing. Now, at one point, early on, we were told that we should wash our hands about every 20 minutes, every half an hour. Well, I'm very sorry to disappoint the people who said that. I'm not washing the good bacteria off my hands. Sorry. If I'm in my house and I'm by myself or with my husband or my daughter, you know, the three of us in a bubble, and we're just going about our daily business and nobody's going out, we're just doing it. No, I'm not washing my hands every 20 minutes or every half an hour. I want the good bacteria. Good bacteria live in this world as well as bad bacteria. So we want to keep the good stuff. We need the good stuff to help fight off not so much fight off, but to be the opposite of the bad bacteria. Because as above, so below. If we have bad bacteria, we have to have good. If we have people who are bad, there are people who are good. If we have leaders who are bad, there are leaders who are good. If we have leaders who tell us daily, okay, this is how good our country is doing right now. This is what we've done to, and the words flatten the curve, because they've talked about the massive curve in healthcare. The fact that we may have started off 2020 with 20 people with some type of a cold, and then we run into the millions of people, the over half a million people who have passed away because of this brand new virus that is mutating as I'm recording this. I know this virus is mutating. Anybody with half a clue knows this is, if it's a virus, that's what viruses do. They change over time. And I guess we have been put on this earth to figure out how do we accommodate or not accommodate viral activity. Viral activity being germs, nonsense that's put online that people will go, oh my heavens, oh look, oh dear, oh my, what's the world coming to? Those kinds of things can be viral too, but so can a child's laughter. So can that little puppy dog who might be crying now or might be, I don't know, barking out of joy. All of that can be viral as well. Why can't we spread a virus of joy throughout this world? Can somebody please answer that for me? Why can't we spread a virus of peace worldwide? If we are able to spread a virus that can kill upwards of millions of people, why can't we spread a virus of peace that can infect trillions, billions, however many people are on this planet? Why can't we do that? That's probably one of the reasons I've been silent, because in my opening up of my speech now, I'm asking the entire world, instead of worrying about this virus that's happening, follow protocol. Wear a mask if you're outside so you don't infect someone else. Wear a mask when we're inside. If we're talking to people and we're afraid we've got a germ, we're not really sure, put that mask on to keep your germs to yourself. Okay? Wash your hands normally, regularly. As you come in from outside, wash your hands. If you're doing something with a product that just came in a package in your mail, wash your hands. That's normal. That's normal. Washing your hands every 20 minutes, every half an hour, for starters, is obsessive. It can cause all kinds of bacteria to enter your body simply because you're not letting the good bacteria take care of what it should. Okay? So following normal cleanliness practices. You don't need to go out and buy 78 rolls of toilet paper. 78 rolls of toilet paper is not going to protect you from a virus that can infect you. How about infecting yourself with peace? How about infecting yourself with joy? How about infecting yourself with goodness? How about infecting yourself with empathy for the rest of the world? How about the whole issue of race should not even be an issue? We are human beings. It matters not if we are pink, yellow, blue, green, orange,
terracotta, red, you name the color, you name it, whatever color you can think of, why does it matter? We are all human beings put on a planet. We came to this planet, this beautiful blue planet, to uplift this planet. Originally, the blueprint for this planet was euphoria. What have we done to it? We were the ones who did it. We're human beings. We are the harshest, meanest animal on this planet. You know, you see these dogs, okay? So for instance, the ones that have the bad names are Rottweilers, Dobermans, and whatever. Oh, and Chihuahuas, because Chihuahuas are supposed to be the fiercest of all the animals on the planet. Okay, so I have Chihuahuas in my family. They're not fierce. These dogs are not fierce. However, if the owner of the dog was fierce, the dog would be fierce. My brother had a Rottweiler, and I never ever called that dog a Rottweiler. He was a Rottie simply because he was beautiful. He was this ambling old dog who would walk towards you and lay his big head in your lap and just kind of look at you and go, Simply because his owner was a beautiful person who loved his animal, who loved his pet. Okay, so you out there who have pets, look at your pet. And in your mind, ask your pet, am I a good pet to this pet? Does this pet of mine, this bunny rabbit, this kitten, this cat, this dog, this puppy, this horse, this whatever your pet of choice is, ask yourself, am I a good human pet to my pet? Do I treat my pet the way I want to be treated? Or am I going to say, you're just a bag of fur? What do you like? You don't know. Guess what? They do know. They know a lot more than we know. And they can feel a lot more than we can feel. They can hear a lot more than we can hear. My goodness, I could go on and on and on now for hours simply because I guess I haven't spoken in so long. But I'll just give you a few insights of what I was going through during this pandemic. In the beginning, during the lockdown, in the very first weeks of the lockdown, I have to say I felt a peace that I haven't felt in a long, long time. About 6 weeks in, after many, several events that happened with me personally, physically, I started to feel the overwhelming sensation of sadness more than anything. And I think it was a collective sadness worldwide. Simply because I look at my favorite city in the entire world, and my favorite city in the entire world is New York City. When I watched what was happening, my heart broke. It actually broke. Because that city, it's the absolute truth about, there's a song that Jay-Z and Alicia Keys do. And it's called the Empire State. And one of the lines in it, the streets will make you feel brand new. Its lights will inspire you. And it always did. I actually trained to be a hairstylist in New York City in the 70s when it was the years of bad cops and all the, you know, getting mugged. And never once did I see any of that. None of it. I saw lots of beautifully fresh cut flowers. I saw lots of beautiful people who treated me like a queen. So I have nothing bad to say about New York City. But now, it just breaks my heart to know that the country is being decimated by this illness. And I'm not going to mention anything political at all. I'm not a political person. However, in this instance, I understand that the United States needs help. The United States needs more than our help. The United States needs help that we as human beings can't seem or don't seem to be able to provide. I do see over the next couple of years a major division between the United States and Canada, simply because we're Canadian. Listen, what more can I say? I mean, that's been the Canadian thing. You know, if you say the word A after anything, you're definitely Canadian. Well, I don't say A after everything. I generally say, what do you, bye? Because I am a Newfoundlander and I do love this province. And today I actually speak with a tiny tinge of fear because for the first time in a couple of months now, our border is opening. We have no, as of this minute, which is 5:20 on Friday, July the 3rd, we have no COVID. Our island is COVID-19 free. What's going to happen over the next 2 weeks? Who knows? I live in a little fear with that. I wish that the airports would stay, not necessarily stay closed. Yes, welcome to our own. Please do not bring your germs to our island. Please do not. I know that there are several factions in the U.S. that are apparently now, I only heard this morning, there are people partying in the United States, and they're offering prizes at these parties, and the top prize at these parties is COVID-19, and it's who can catch COVID first. I think that's a little bit over the top right now, especially for people whose immune systems are compromised at all. So having said all that, I didn't mean for this to be a pandemic chat, but that's what's been happening over the past few months. And a really good friend of mine is an astrologer who last year predicted all of this. She predicted something really, really heavy is happening at the beginning of the year. So most people who live on our island know what Snowmageddon, what happened when we had this event called Snowmageddon. To those of you out there who are not Newfoundlanders and don't have a clue what Snowmageddon is, back in January, we had a snowstorm that dropped 90 centimeters of snow on us. Now, I'm not a centimeters person. I know there are 2 point something centimeters in an inch. So we received over 45 inches of snow in one snowfall. It was very scary. It was, for a lot of people, it was horrendous. It really was. We did have to call in our forces, our armed forces, simply because the cities here needed the help in clearing the snow. And I totally get it. Totally understand it. I was behind it 100%. We thought that was the big thing that was going to happen. No, it wasn't. So when the lockdown happened, we realized, okay, here we are. We're in the middle of it. This is it. So that was fine. We all thought, okay, we're in the middle of it now. And when this is over, everything will be fine. Well, we found out that no, this is not the end of it. This is the beginning of it. I paused when I said that because I hope a lot of people heard me and I hope a lot of people listened. This is the beginning. I want everyone to make themselves ready and not to be in shock, not to be jolted, not to be terrified or anything else, just be aware. What we have coming this fall is what we've never seen before. Now, we thought Snowmageddon we'd never seen before. We who are over 60 years old in Newfoundland remember winters similar to what we had. Nothing with that type of snowfall, but we over a full winter, we would get that amount of snow. So that's not an unusual. What's coming for this fall, I fear, isn't unusual for us in this century. It was seen in the 18th century, in the 1800s, so the 19th century, but not in this century. None of us have seen it. So I want everybody out there just to be prepared. I'm not scaring any. This is not meant to be a scare tactic for anyone at all. So put your awareness cap on. If you feel the need to go out and buy 70,000 rolls of toilet paper, do it now. You know, if you feel the need that you're going to need to buy, I don't know, wood for your fireplace, whatever, do it now. Get it done before the end of September, please. September is going to be all right. September is going to be fine from what I've heard. And all of this is because of part of it. No, I say all of it, but I don't mean all of it. Part of it is because of the alignment of the stars. Okay, the stars and the planets. And that's what it comes down to. But understand one more thing. All of this is leading to something absolutely beautiful and absolutely amazing. And I want to leave you with that. I want to leave you protecting yourself and your family and all of those around you, every single loved one around you, every person that you even like. Keep them in your mind. Keep the awareness there that, okay, we've been through this now. We've been through the Snowmageddon. We've been through the lockdown. So now we as an island are anticipating another upturn because of opening our borders. That will be dealt with as well as everything else. So until I speak again, and heaven only knows when I will, I want to thank you for listening. I want to thank John for the opportunity to present this to you at this time. And I want to say to everyone, I love you all for listening. Please stay safe until we speak again.
C is for your claws so sharp to me. R is for reports we seldom see. Why do we ignore creatures of myth and lore? B is even more puzzling monsters we adore. T is for tales passed through the years. I is for icons of all our fears. D is for discovery of strange creatures in every country. It's the cryptid corner north to Newfoundland. Yeah, yeah.
In the folklore of Lee County, South Carolina, the lizard man of Scape or Swamp, also known as the lizard man of Lee County, is an entity said to inhabit the swampland of the region. First mentioned in the late 1980s, the purported sightings and damage attributed to the creature yielded a significant amount of newspaper, radio, and television publicity. Professor of Religious Studies Joseph P. Laycock described the media frenzy and subsequent cult appreciation for this and other similar claims as following a predictable chain of events. A strange sighting, media attention, more sightings, followed by visits from curious tourists and monster hunters. Researcher Ben Radford states that this is a compelling story, but several important aspects wither under skeptical scrutiny. On July 14, 1988, the Lee County Sheriff's Office investigated a report of a car damaged overnight while parked at a home in the area of Browntown outside of Bishopville, South Carolina, on the edges of Scape or Swamp. The car reportedly had tooth marks and scratches with hair and muddy footprints left behind. Sheriff Liston Truesdale noted this was the start of a various claim that eventually coalesced into the story about a lizard man in the swamp. Prompted by the news of the vehicle damage, 17-year-old local Christopher Davis reported to the sheriff that this car was damaged by a creature he described as green, wet-like, about 7 feet tall, that had three fingers, red eyes, skin like a lizard, and snake-like scales. According to Davis, he was driving home from working the night shift at a fast food restaurant when his car got a flat tire. After fixing it, he saw a creature walking toward him. Davis got in his car and began to drive, but the creature was soon on top of the car. He applied his brakes, causing the creature to roll off the car, giving Davis enough time to escape. Coverage by newspapers and media resulted in increased attention for his claims. Local businesses began selling Lizard Man t-shirts, and the local Chamber of Commerce encouraged the media attention as good for the community. The increase in newspaper and media publicity prompted further reports of sightings, and the area soon became a tourist attraction for visitors and hunters alike. Local radio station WCOS offered a $1 million reward to anybody who could capture the thing alive. On August 5th, Kenneth Orr, an airman stationed at the local airbase, filed a police report that he had encountered the lizard man on Highway 15. He had shot and wounded it while doing so. He presented several scales and a small quantity of blood as evidence. Orr recanted this account 2 days later when he was arraigned for unlawfully carrying a pistol and misdemeanor offense of filing a false police report. According to Orr, he had hoaxed the sighting in order to keep stories about the lizard man in circulation. Reports of the creature gradually declined at the end of the summer. Local law enforcement officials speculated that the sightings were likely to have been caused by a bear. In 2008, CNN mentioned the lizard man legend in a story about a couple of Bishopville, South Carolina, who reported damage to their vehicle as well, including blood traces. The blood traces were subsequently found to be from a domestic dog, though the local sheriff suggested it may have been a coyote or a wolf. In 2015, local television station WCIV featured photos and videos claimed to be the lizard man, allegedly taken by unidentified individuals. In August 2017, the South Carolina Emergency Management Division sent a humorous tweet regarding possible paranormal activity during the solar eclipse that passed over the area, hinting that people of Lee and Sumter counties should remain vigilant for sightings of the lizard man. So what do you guys think? Is the lizard man the real deal? Whatever he is, or whoever he certainly deserves to be right here on the Odd the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast's Cryptid Corner.
And welcome to Dr. Norris Lair. Power on. I'll get the broom.
Happy anniversary to the Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. And of course, happy anniversary, John. With all the talk of social distancing and masks and COVID-19 disease, I've been really wondering, is distancing something that we see in other species in nature? Would you believe that this may happen in trees? In a really interesting article by Emily Osterloff, she covers just that very topic in an article from the Natural History Museum in the UK in April of this year. Some trees have been keeping their distance from one another, but were doing so long before we started. When one or many trees fall in a forest, different gaps occur, but neighboring trees usually rapidly grow into these spaces. In some forests, if you were to look up at the treetops, you might spot conspicuous channel-like gaps between the outermost branches of the trees above your head. This striking balance border around trees is known as crown shyness. Scientists have been discussing this phenomenon since the 1920s, proposing multiple potential reasons for why it occurs. Crown shyness doesn't occur between all trees. It has been documented in black mangrove trees, lodgepole pines, Japanese larches, and some species of eucalypt and other species. Typically, it's seen between trees of the same species, but it can also occur between individuals of different species, such as between spiny hackberries and amberoi. Some scientists propose that the gaps can be formed by wind moving the canopy and causing abrasion between trees of similar heights. The branches and leaves and buds of neighboring trees scrape against each other, causing damage and breakage. A 1955 study of eucalypts in northeast Australia, where severe wind often causes contact between trees, convinced scientists that abrasion led to the death of trees' sensitive growing tips, resulting in these spacings. Subsequently, in 1984, research was published on an area of Costa Rica dominated by black mangroves. Scientists picked 22 pairs of trees of a similar height at random and measured the distance between them during still conditions, as well as their maximum horizontal movement during gust of wind. They found that during calm conditions, the branches interlocked like loosely fitting pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. When the wind gusted between the branches would often touch and become intertwined. The branches at the edge of the crown shyness gaps were generally found to have broken twigs and fewer leaves than more protected parts of the canopy, suggesting interaction with other trees was a key cause of damage. As well as occurring between neighboring trees, the crown shyness phenomenon can also occur between independently swaying branches of a single tree. If abrasion is the primary cause of crown shyness, you would expect it to be more pronounced among trees in highly windy locations, like Newfoundland and Labrador, than those growing in sheltered spots. But this was not found to be the case in a study of Monteverde Cloud Forest Reserve in Costa Rica. This cloud forest is frequently subjected to high winds. They regularly exceed 100 kilometers per hour in some places during the winter. Little difference was found in the crown shyness of trees in windy areas compared to more sheltered areas. The scientists observed that trees in the more windswept locations had adaptations that make the trees resistant to strong winds, such as thicker trunks and shorter, stouter twigs. These adaptations would minimize the ability of branches to clip neighboring trees during the wind. Despite this, there was some evidence of dead twigs at the edges of the trees, suggesting that the wind does not actually cause the abrasive contact. While abrasion is likely the cause of crown shyness in some cases, it may not be the only one. In a study of crown shyness in the Malay camphor tree, there was found to be no evidence of direct abrasion. The scientists studying these trees suggested that in this species, crown shyness may instead be caused by the tree's growing tips being able to sense light and so stop growing when they are near the foliage of another neighboring tree. Research shows that plants can detect a frequency of visible light called far red light, which can tell how close they are to their neighbors. They can also use the blue light in the spectrum to avoid growing in the shade. As with animals, plants also compete for resources, including nutrients, water, space, and light to survive. In forested areas with dense canopies, there is an intense competition between plants for light. It is possible that the gaps in the canopy resulting from crown shyness allow trees to increase their exposure to light and then optimize the process of photosynthesis. While scientists are still debating the potential causes of crown shyness, there have been also some suggestions for it having additional positive side effects. Crown shyness can let light reach the forest floor, which would benefit other plants and other animals that may in turn be beneficial to the trees. Additionally, by having branches that do not physically touch those of their neighbors, trees may also be able to limit the spread of harmful leaf-eating insects and, potentially, also the transmission of harmful diseases from tree to tree. Oh, boy, oh boy, nature is so fascinating. Now that we got to the root of that question, take care, everyone. I have to make like a tree and leaf, but don't forget to social distance and wear your mask as you are able.
Attention all Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn radio listeners. The Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast brings you the best in East Coast esoterica on the first of every month. Together, we can keep it growing by sharing the show on social media, subscribing to the show wherever you may be listening to it from, and by leaving feedback about your favorite episodes. John certainly needs a friend like you to help make his dreams come true, minus the alien abduction dreams. That is not cool at all. The Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. Always available. Always free. Always odd.
Tonight's guest is an author of idea-driven fiction, dark humor, and political commentary. His experience as the founding director of the Yale Writers Conference to the company of writers offering editing and manuscript services to authors at all points in their careers. I might have to hit this guy up myself because he's actually the author of three books right now that we're going to be talking about tonight. One is called Rage of Achilles. The other one's called American Neolithic. And his most recent one, which brings him to the Odd the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast, is Turing's Graveyard Stories. Sounds a little spooky, or at least a little dark. That's right. Tonight, I have the pleasure of talking to Terrence Hawkins on the Odd the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. Sir, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you? Thank you for having me.
I love authors. I'm one myself, and I know how hard it can be. So when I see there's a successful guy out there doing this and helping other people, I got to get you on because I got to help you. And so thank you so much for taking the time yourself. I can think of a thousand questions where to start this to, but Turing's Graveyard Stories. Tell me a little tiny bit about this book.
It's a collection of short stories and some humor that I've published over the course of the past 20 years. And one of the interesting things for a writer, at least this writer, about working on stuff that you've published for such a long period of time is that you can see yourself, how your own writing style has changed and hopefully grown over the years. It was interesting as well to work on a collection, as I say, of stuff that was published over two decades, because I was able to see how certain topics have to be handled differently today than they had to be 20 years ago. It's really been a fascinating process. The process of collecting all these stories was also quite interesting because we had to sort of decide how certain themes in each of the stories would work together and how you would put the stories together in the sequence.
Terrence, what was your inspiration for creating this collection of stories?
Well, since it's a collection of different stories, the inspiration was different for each. For example, and most of my stories tend to be driven more by an idea, which is common in speculative fiction, certainly, than it is by a character or by plot. The plot and the characters serve the idea rather than the other way around. So in the case of the title and story, Turing's Graveyard, I tried to explore some topics that have been in my mind for probably since my adolescence, and I hate to tell you how far in the past my adolescence is.
Can I take a stab at it? No, you go ahead. Keep going.
Let's just say there were more stars on the flag and leave it at that, okay? But in any event, Turing's Graveyard is in part about the uploading of memories and perhaps consciousness to a computer. It's also, in part, maybe a ghost story. But it also concerns what's known as Turing's challenge or Turing's paradox, which is very topical now in a time in which true artificial intelligence seems to be on the very near horizon. Turing's challenge, and for those of you who may not have heard of him, Turing was a title character, by the way, in the movie The Imitation Game. He was the father of modern computer science, and he posed this paradox. Let's say two people are communicating by teletype, if you can remember what a teletype is, and they communicate every day. It's their job. They exchange weather reports, stock prices, something like that. And over the course of years, they develop friendship. They start talking about their families, talk about the weather, things like that. One day, one of them is going to retire. And he says to the other guy, and I understand he's never met this other guy, hey, tell you what, I know you're on the other side of the world, but why don't we manage somehow to get together? We've been friends now for 20 years. And the person on the other end says, I can't. I'm a machine. So Turing's question was, if a machine can imitate a human being so perfectly that it fools the human being, what difference does it make? Is that machine a person? So that's one of the ideas behind the title story. And as when we get to the question of the uploaded consciousness, that again has become kind of very current in a lot of SF. You know, the whole idea that we can become immortal by transferring our identities somehow from our brains to a computer that will presumably never die. And one of the ideas that's kind of bugged me about that whole concept is, well, you're not really transferring yourself, you're copying yourself. And so you're not truly immortal in that respect. So those are kind of the ideas, those are the ideas behind Turing's graveyard. In another of the stories, The Darkness at the Center of Everything, the sun apparently disappears in the modern world. And in the story, we toggle back and forth between the modern world and ancient Sumeria when astronomy is being discovered. So the idea there is, to what extent is our belief in science similar to our belief in religion, to the extent we have any? How are they the same and how are they different? And then finally, to give you a third example, which is timely given the fact that this is being recorded on, I believe it's Maundy Thursday, right before Good Friday, there's a story, a first-person account of Jesus's time on the cross. And the question that I deal with there is what the real significance of the crucifixion is. Because even as a boy in catechism, I always used to wonder, well, if Jesus knew he was God, why was the crucifixion a sacrifice? And I try to answer that in some ways.
Awesome stuff. You know, we can't say, you know, a collection of stories, you know, without having multiple genres in there. And, you know, certain topics reoccur in the stories, of course. And, well, most notably is religion and infidelity. You know, first is, who hurt you? but why? Why religion and infidelity? Like, over and over. Like, what's up with that? What's going on here?
Well, you know, religion isn't one of my personal preoccupations, or at least I don't think so. But as I did mention, I referred to catechism, and you asked who hurt me, so those two questions tend to go together. I do think, however, that religion has really been a central preoccupation of most people for most of time. This really, a friend of mine, John Crowley, the fantasy writer, and I were talking about Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall, the first installment in the trilogy, which is set in the early reign of Henry VIII. And Crowley said that what Hilary Mantel got wrong in that book was that even though people think about religion a lot, they didn't think about it enough for the book to be accurate because people thought about religion all the time. And I think that's been true for most of our history, most of Western history, at least. Perhaps, though, I may be a little bit skewed in that respect because in religion is very much part of American public life, which it is not, I understand, in Canada. So that may drive some of it as well. As to infidelity, I guess I have to say that's infidelity has certainly driven a lot of literature. It's been an important topic in many writers' work. It does make me a little nervous to see that to see people catching that. And you know, I have to tell you, sometimes I don't see things in my own work until it's been out for a while. Sometimes I catch things in my own work as I'm writing them that were unintended, but seem to form a pattern. So when that happens, I try to push them further. For example, slightly off topic, in my novel American Neolithic, I noticed that one of the protagonists seemed to be using a lot of Catholic themes in his narrative. That was completely unintentional. It was just coming out in the narrative, and I decided to push that a little bit further consciously. But a lot of this comes out unconsciously, and I suppose when my wife hears this podcast, I'm going to have some explaining to do.
You know, look, what can I say? Everybody loves a good, we call it, you know, romance novel. And then there's the unromance novel. And then there's the cheating novel. Everybody loves that. Like Harlequin Romance, man. Like, this is a gold mine. Just tell her it's a gold mine. We'll be fine.
Yes.
You know, I'd like to think that you must have poured a lot of time into research for all these topics before you wrote about them. Even though a lot of your writing comes from the heart and then the dark recesses of your mind, Terrence, for this particular in foray, shall we say, I just love Greek mythology. So tell me a little bit about Rage of Achilles. I know we're going back in time and talking about another book now, but you know, I can't help it. We got to talk about this book because I just love the pantheon of gods and heroes. You know, I love this. So tell me a little tiny bit about that book and how you took this, really the Iliad, really, and turned it into like kind of a modern spin kind of thing and made it more like a, you made it more realistic. Like you took something that was written in an older language and really made it really more modern. So tell me a little tiny bit about that.
Well, it came into being in a couple of different ways. I happened to be reading Christopher Loeb's War Music, which is an adaptation or a kind of the Iliad in modern prose, modern poetry. And at the same time, I saw Saving Private Ryan for the first time. So I started to think about what would an actual Trojan War look like? I mean, it took place the consensus is somewhere between 800 and 1100 BCE, and the Homer's account is that it's essentially 10,000 men going up against a city of 50,000. Also in my mind as I was writing it, though, was a book that I had floating around in the back of my head forever, which is Julian Jayne's book, The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind, and I swear that is its real title.
Wow, that's really long. Yeah. Can you say that again? What was the name of that book again? Sorry.
The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind.
Mm.
And believe it or not, it is a hot topic right now because a whole episode of HBO's Westworld is called The Bicameral Mind.
Mm.
So, and it's kind of referred to as the philosophy underlying Westworld. But anyway, the book came out in about 1980, and James's hypothesis is that people didn't become truly conscious until language became so complicated that it caused one hemisphere of the brain, the one containing the language center, to become dominant. Before that time, people were kind of, you know, bumbling around like sleepwalkers. And whenever they encountered a task that required them to think out of the box, so to speak, they would hear the voices of the other hemisphere of their brains as the voices of the gods, telling them how to get out of this situation or what to do. And when language, as I say, became complicated enough, people started thinking with their whole brains. And James's hypothesis was that this happened at the time of the events depicted in the Iliad. And he relies on a lot of textual evidence in the Iliad for that notion. But what I tried to do, I mean, there are elements of the bicameral mind theory in the text. But what I really tried to do is stay close to the idea that it really happened. That is, that there were 10,000 guys on the beach for 9.5 years at the time of the Iliad. And that's not a pretty situation. And I also tried to think about what Bronze Age warfare would really look like. And that isn't a pretty picture either. The actual events of the Iliad cannot have been nearly as heroic as they were depicted to be. And because the book is driven, as I say, in part by James's theory, the gods do appear, but they appear as hallucinations to men, and in one case, a woman, under extreme stress, which in this transitional period between the bicameral mind and the modern mind is the only time the gods really appear.
You know, to me, it's always about, you know, just watching all those old movies and even cartoons, and just how much those gods are still very much a part of our pop culture, really. I mean,
oh yeah.
How many times have you heard about Hercules and Hermes and all this stuff? And it's interesting that all those characters, what they are, they're archetypes, really. And it's interesting that they're still very prevalent and can still really weave a nice story even to this day. Well, maybe not nice, more like blood and gore in your case, right?
Yeah. Well, one of the fascinating things about the Greek pantheon is that it was universal in the ancient world, just with the gods had different names. So that, you know, Zeus was Jupiter in Rome and Osiris in Egypt.
So speaking of these characters, I'm sure you have your own original ones as well. How do you come up with your own characters, Terrence? You know, for me, I've never written fiction. I've always been nonfiction writer myself. But, I'm blessed with what I write about already exists or might exist. We're not really sure. But with you, it's kind of got to make up those names, those faces, those places. You know, what really helps you create those characters?
Well, many of my characters are, I won't say they're thinly veiled real people, but they are amalgams of people I actually know. I'll do things like transpose their names. Speaking of noticing things in your own work and transposing names, I've noticed that none of my male characters have ever had a first name. I have no idea why that is. I just noticed it a couple of weeks ago, and it's been consistent for 25 years or so. But when I tend not to think up too many characters in advance, but rather let the story tell me what characters I'm going to need. For example, to refer back to American Neolithic, I was wondering whether the protagonist needed a girlfriend. And I was walking down the street and I saw somebody I know and I said, oh yeah, that's her. It is dictated in part by the needs of the story and in part by chance.
You know, speaking more about, you know, towards the characters and archetypes and stuff like that, you know, it's time for me to ask kind of one of those oddball questions. I got to do at least three per interview. So here comes the first one, you know.
Sure.
Okay. As a writer, what would you choose as your avatar or spirit animal?
I don't think for me, it'd have to be a dog.
Well, there you go. See, now this is going to get real interesting. Tell me a little tiny bit of why that would be.
Well, I'm a dog person. I have always been a dog person. Aww. And it's funny. My people have asked, I've been referring to protagonists in American Neolithic, and there are two, one of whom is a Neanderthal. And people have commented on his voice. And I always tell them that I think I am channeling my last dog, because I always thought that if he could speak, he would have spoken in that voice and with that diction.
And you know what? If you ever need someone to voice that caveman, I do voice and character work for different novels. You know, what's the best way for, you know, I'm kind of jumping the gun here, but you're a bit of a mentor, let's be honest, to other writers out there, right? You became a mentor at Visible Ink, which is a creative writing program for cancer survivors at Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital, which I think is just a beautiful thing. In fact, the reason why I do everything I do, the reason why I got into the paranormal and alternative thought is because of my father, who's a cancer survivor. And I feel like it's important to kind of jump out there. But, you know, what advice do you have for people out there right now who you know, they kind of already put the pen to the paper. They got some ideas, but they don't know what to do next. Well, what would be your first piece of advice for aspiring authors out there?
Well, I do think that for every writer, the fear of the blank page or now the blank screen is almost paralyzing. And I think the magazine Poets and Writers sells a coffee cup with a quote from William Wordsworth on it, which is "to begin, begin." So you just throw a couple of words up there and see where it takes you. At least that has been my approach. But other people I know outline extensively so that the outline of a book can be a tenth of the length of the book itself. I have a number of little tricks that I picked up from other people that have gotten me through. For example, I think it was Hemingway who said that you should always stop in the middle of a sentence so that it, by rereading the sentence the next day, you'll know where you were going, or you'll have a feel for where you are going. But that's kind of down in the weeds. I think the big question for people who are beginning is, once you've overcome the fear of the page, people ask questions about, well, how long their story should be, how long their work should be. Everybody, of course, is concerned about marketing and publishing in this a market that was changing quite a lot before coronavirus hit, and now the publishing industry appears to be paralyzed. But that's kind of a digression. I think that the question a beginning writer or a writer who wants to get started has to ask himself is how badly he wants to do it, he or she wants to do it. You said at the outset of this interview that it can be kind of a tough job, and it's certainly at times a lonely job. And I think the question you have to ask yourself more than anything else is, how would I feel about myself if I didn't try to do this? And if you'd be okay with yourself if you didn't, then don't worry about it. But if you know in your heart that you would never forgive yourself if you never tried, then this is the job for you. So then it's time to simply start putting words on paper or on the screen and to set yourself a minimum of what you're going to do every day. But certainly while you're starting, make a point of writing every day.
Do you find that writing energizes you, Terrence, or do you find it kind of drains you and you can only do it for so long? Like there's two types of authors. You know, there's the Stephen Kings who, you know, haven't stopped writing since like for 30 years straight. I'm pretty sure they just like shift another completely new computer once he fries the last one. He just keeps on writing and writing and writing. You know, the people who are energized by it. And then there's other people like kind of like me. What? I hate to relate to it, but like I'm the drain type. When I was writing my book, it was just, sure, I found it very draining and tiring. What category would you fit into?
It depends on what I'm working on and, you know, kind of like what else is going on in my life at the time. This really isn't quite yet a direct answer, but I wrote my first two books, I wrote primarily on the weekends and primarily at night. Because my nephews and nieces were very young at the time, and my wife would babysit for them, so I would have an 8-hour stretch every night to work, and I could work at that point. I could write for 5 or 6 hours straight, and over the course of a weekend, then I might get 1,000 words or 2,000. Actually, 2,000 words was the average. Recently, and by recently, I mean in the past couple of years, I've become a morning writer. In fact, let me correct myself a little bit. When I was writing The Rage of Achilles, most of it was written at night and on weekends on the schedule I just described to you. But there are a couple of chapters that were written in the morning because I just wanted to see how that worked. And I've asked people if they could tell whether there was a change in the style or the flow at any point during the book, and the answer usually is no. So I've come to the conclusion that it doesn't, in my case at least, make a substantial difference as to when you write. I don't think, though, to get to the Stephen King question, I don't think I could write that much. I mean, I'm just not that prolific. I won't say that I'm the kind of guy who agonizes over every word, because usually when I have a flow going, I can knock out 400 words at a sitting. But if I'm not ready to do that, I just don't do it.
Interesting stuff.
Don't dodge the question successfully.
Listen, man, you did a great job. I guess the idea, though, is that, you know, some people are drained by it, some people, and it's okay to be both. You know what I mean? Like, and then there's the other part of it too, where you get on this big writing tear for like 3 or 4 hours, and you're doing great, and you're pumping all kinds of word, and you're like, oh man, I haven't spelled anything wrong in a long time. I'm doing great, and then you look up and you're like, wow, I haven't eaten in 6 hours. Holy crap, I'm tired. Wow, I have a beard. When did this happen? Like, you know, like these kind of things happen as authors. So it's interesting that you have that. You know. This is a paranormal podcast, and you know, I always ask people, have you ever had any kind of an experience in your life where made you kind of go, something's not right here, or something's kind of strange? You know, some people talk about deja vu. Some people talk about their own ghostly encounters. Is there anything that's happened to you in your own life, Terrence, that you might want to talk about on the show tonight, just to kind of add to the paranormal portion of the show?
You know, I was thinking about that in connection with the book. So if you'll let me digress a little bit and
sure.
try to see if the back of my mind can come up with something there. I first heard the expression cryptids on your show. As I was preparing for this recording, I listened to some episodes, and it occurred to me that the legend of the it did occur to me some time ago that our legends of the Sasquatch or the Yeti or even trolls or kobolds may be sort of a racial memory of the time Neanderthals and human beings, modern human beings, interacted. So I kind of throw that out as an idea. And of course, since American Neolithic concerns Neanderthal survival into the present day, that I have to ask myself whether it is possible that there might still be Neanderthals hanging around somewhere. Because certainly the little people, there's a human species recently discovered on the island of Flores in Indonesia, who are known certainly to have gone extinct just 16,000 years ago. And the people of Flores have legends of a little people living in the woods as recently as 300 years ago before they were exterminated by the Dutch. So that's a little bit of shameless commerce there. But to get back to my own, experiences, I have had moments in which I've reflexively assumed that there was some kind of paranormal presence in my life. Most recently, my father, I laugh, but this does not begin like a funny story, but bear with me. My father died in early January of 2016. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning when I left his nursing home and headed back to his place after he'd gone. The first weird thing that happened is that I have Sirius radio in my car, and I never, ever listen to jazz when I'm driving, especially because I've just driven 12 hours. I'm afraid jazz will put me to sleep. So I turn on the car. It is jazz, and it's Horace Silver's Song for My Father. So I thought, wow, that's weird. So I drive back to his place. I park in the parking lot. As I say, it's by this point almost 4 in the morning. It's January. There's black ice all over the parking lot. I get out of the car. My feet slip. I land flat on my back. And without thinking, I shake my fist at the sky and said, that wasn't funny, goddammit. So I assumed he was behind it somehow. I don't think I've had any more direct experiences with the paranormal. But I will tell you this, that I think anybody who rules out the possibility of the paranormal doesn't know anything about quantum physics.
Absolutely. Oh, my God. The whole you just opened up the can of worms, Terrence. You did it. Way to go, man. Because we're going to go all double slit experiment. And that's just the start of this stuff. You know, how we influence light just being in the room. Like, there's all kinds of stuff in science. As we get smaller and smaller, we get more and more paranormal. And, you know, we only just recently kind of proven Einstein's leading theories, which is gravitational waves. So, you know, we really do know absolutely nothing. So who's to say that there really wasn't a gigantic war, you know, where Achilles was killing a bunch of other guys with 10,000 of his buddies? Or who's to say there might not be still be Neanderthals in a more modern era? And who's to say that, you know, graveyard stories can't be true? Guys, I got one last question for tonight's author, Terrence Hawkins. You grew up in Uniontown.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, and guess what they shot in Uniontown? I never ever heard of the movie American Rust, but I do know what The Night of the Living Dead is. How has your hometown influenced your writing? Let's give them a big shout out before we say goodbye.
Well, it's funny. My hometown actually is the entire basis for one of the stories in Turing's Graveyard, which is called Coal Town Heart. There was, in the center of town, this kind of Adams family mansion that had been abandoned for long enough for it to be completely covered over with ivy. The windows were boarded up, so on and so on. The rumor I heard when I was a little boy is that it had been the home of the Princess of Taxes. And even then I thought, what would a European princess be doing living in Uniontown, PA? It turned out there was one. That in 1916, a girl from Brownsville, PA, married Prince Victor von Thurn und Taxis of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And he died in the 1920s, and she came back to Uniontown afterwards to live and basically split her time between Europe and Uniontown. And understand, Uniontown is a town of 20,000 people. So I just could never make sense of the story. I found out everything about her I could, but then wrote a fairly substantial story about her, kind of imagining what her life in Europe had been like. There's also another story in the collection that the Kirkus Reviews referred to as the darkest image in the collection. And I won't spoil this for anybody, but I thought it was based on something I had heard from my family when I was a little boy. So after the story came out, I was at some kind of family gathering, and I asked people if they'd ever heard of this thing happening, and uniformly were saying, "No, what is the matter with you? How would you even think of something like that?" So, but I have a very clear recollection of where I was when I heard the story that apparently is completely a product of my imagination. So, and to go back to the protagonist in American Neolithic, so much of what I remembered growing up kept popping up that I decided to make not only him a native of Uniontown, PA, but to make a minor character. And just as one of the characters in American Neolithic is a guy named Captain Grainer. You may not, being where you are, remember the Abu Ghraib prison scandal in the Iraq War, Second Iraq War, where Americans were torturing Iraqi prisoners. Well, the guy who was the ringleader of that operation was a guy named Grainer, who, as it happens, grew up in Uniontown, PA, where he had been a guard in the jail. So, a lot of material there.
Yeah, really? Yeah, 6 degrees of separation, you know what I mean? Like, it's definitely, yes. It's a true thing. Guys, his name is Terrence Hawkins, prolific author. He talked about 3 books tonight, Rage of Achilles, America, Neolithic, and here's a chance to plug your most recent book, Turing's Graveyard Stories. All these 5 books can be found on his website. Terrence, I got a couple of different websites for you, actually, but what would be the main one where people can go and check you out?
Terrence-Hawkins.com, and it's T-E-R-E-N-Z-E, one R.
There you go. Terrence, thank you so much for taking the time.
It's a pleasure.
Really, and I love prying that ghost story out of you. You take care of yourself now, okay?
You too, my friend. Take care.
Well, the time to say goodbye is upon us. But don't worry, you can keep track of the Odd Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast very easily. It's available on Stitcher, iTunes, Podbean, and TuneIn Radio. Just look for the Odd Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast banner. Of course, if you'd like to keep up to date, you can always check out the Odd Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast Facebook page, drop a like, and every single time a new show goes up, you'll be notified. You can also follow me, John Mallard, on Twitter, @ODDTONFLD. That's Odd to Newfoundland. Get your latest news on the podcast as well as the ever popular parajoke of the day. From the oldest city in North America, I bid you adieu from the Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast.